Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're tuned into NPR News today. This hour, the future, the promise, and the ethical challenges of gene editing. You've probably heard this referred to as CRISPR, a chemical tool that acts like scissors in cutting genetic material. We'll explain more in just a moment. When the Nobel Committee awarded the 2020 Prize for Chemistry to the two women scientists who pioneered it, Dr. Emmanuelle Charpentier and Dr. Jennifer Doudna, they said CRISPR was rewriting the code of life. What does that mean? We'll talk about that as well. Last week, we got news that researchers were able to safely remove a gene from the liver cells of patients with a serious disease. Researchers have also removed blood stem cells, edited them in the laboratory, and returned them to patients. So today, why gene editing is so profoundly transformational and what it may mean for human heredity, which is why we have a scientist and an ethicist joining us this hour. And you may have questions or observations as you hear our discussion develop. What kinds of ethical concerns come up for you as you listen? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Anywhere in the upper Midwest, you can tweet in at Carrie NPR. Alexis Comer is with us, a professor of chemistry and biology, biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego, and the lead researcher at the Comer Lab in San Diego. Professor Comer, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
And I should say you're doing work in the laboratory, not the library. My mind's on books all the time, but it's good to have you. Jeff Kahn is with us, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, where he is also a professor at the School of Public Health. And Jeff with us from Baltimore. And Jeff, welcome back to the show. Long time no chat, but it's good to hear you again.
Likewise, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
Professor Comer, I want to ask you about that phrase that the Nobel Committee used when awarding the Nobel Prize, because it seems to be miraculously sweeping and somewhat mysterious in some ways. What does it mean to be rewriting the code of life through gene editing?
Well, what these tools enable us to do is to go into people's cells where we have, our genomic DNA. And, I don't know how much of a science background our listeners have, but our DNA is made up of a string of letters. So there's four letters, A, G, C, and T. And there's this precise sort of orientation that they're kind of lined up as. And so everybody has a slightly different sequence. That's what we call it. We call it the sequence. That's the exact sort of pattern that these letters are arranged in each of us. And so sometimes, our DNA sequences are all very similar to each other. But obviously each one of us is very unique. So it is slightly different. And so let's say we're comparing my genomic DNA sequence to yours, and you have a C base at a particular location, okay, C, and I have a T, let's say there. And that small difference, so keep in mind there are, I think, 6 billion of these letters all strung, back to back to back in each of us. So even if, in this one place, we just have this one difference, you have a C, I have a T. And let's say because I have that T there, I am suffering from some disease like sickle cell anemia. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so genome editing would let us, or let scientists, go into my cells, find that location where I have a T and change it back to a C so that it's, we call that wild type. Sometimes it means that now I have your sequence right there at that spot. And I will hopefully no longer suffer from that disease. And so rewriting the code of life, the code of life is this particular sequence of A, C's, G's, and T's that each of us have in our genomic DNA. And sometimes they differ from each other in a way that makes us sick. And genome editing is allowing us to rewrite that to a new sequence so that we are healthy.
Wow. Professor, that really gives us some insight on the majesty of this and the promise. And Jeff, also, I guess, the ethical considerations. I mean, is the, and this is a question I think I ask you every time we talk about ethics, is the ethical conversation about some of the techniques, and we'll get into that in a minute, but is it keeping up with the advancing research and capabilities?
You're right to ask, and it's important that we talk about it every time we have a conversation. And this is a case where we're doing our best. I will say that scientists like Alexis and people who work on ethics and policy like I do and my colleagues do are working together. So this is an example where we're trying to help guide the use and application of, as you called it, this sort of game-changing technology in ways that get us the benefits that we hope they will yield without worrying about or preventing concerns on the, you know, ethics front and harm to the people who we're trying to help. And so it's an example where we're working together. I don't know that, you know, we're ahead of the technology, but it's really hard to be ahead of a technology because that requires being able to predict the future, which we're just not very good at.
And Jeff, this is the tension, right, of what you do in an area of science that is advancing the way this is and holds the kind of promise that it does, but also holds some of the possibility of ways that I guess it could be misused. I know you kind of live and consider in that tension, right?
Exactly. And I know you want to talk about this more later, but the sort of the case example of what you just described is the announcement that's now a few years old, but still very much resonates for this conversation of a physician scientist in China who used the technology that Professor Comer just described and said that he edited human embryos, implanted them into a woman's body, and that twins were born from that effort. So genome edited babies were born, and that's sort of the worrisome case that happens too quickly without appropriate oversight in ways that are not transparent. We're not sure about the safety. We're not sure about the reason for doing so, and so on. So it's a really important moment as the science advances to also have conversations about the ethics and policy oversight of the use of this transformational technology.
Professor Comer, let's talk about that case. Hong Kong, 2018, a Chinese doctor announces that he's used CRISPR and gene editing, as Jeff describes, to alter genes in embryos to make them more resistant to the HIV virus. At the time, Jeff said that this physician was a rogue but not a charlatan. He was using available science. What was wrong with what he did?
So I could talk about this for a really long time, but I'll shorten it. So the main thing is that there was really no sort of unmet medical need that he was sort of addressing. The way that, you know, they were doing this in vitro fertilization to make these twins and implant them into this woman so she could get pregnant. There was a way to do that while basically getting rid of the HIV from the father. Mm-hmm. So there was no reason that these children needed to be made HIV resistant. That was the main thing. And another thing that I'll mention and then I'll stop is just the particular way in which the physician scientist, you know, changed the sequence of their genome. He changed it to a certain sequence that, you know, hasn't been determined to be safe previously.
Okay.
Okay. So you know how my example earlier was, let's say you have a C and I have a T.
Right.
Well, then we change mine to a C. Well, you already have that particular sequence and you're healthy and happy. So we know it's safe. And so in this case, he was changing that sequence to something completely unknown. And so we don't know if that is going to be safe.
So, Jeff, just to linger on this for just a moment, and again, remembering your words, he's a rogue, but not a charlatan. By that, you meant, again, he was using science that was available, but he was ahead of the science, using it irresponsibly. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. And I'll go a little further. Thank you for throwing that quote back at me. I like it, actually. I should remember that I said that. So Dr. Head, J.K. Head, who's the person we're talking about, was, I will say it in past tense because he's sort of now off the map, but he was a member of the community of scientists working with CRISPR, in his case, in vitro, so in the laboratory, human embryos, which is where the concern started to come up that he was working with human embryos, but nobody thought he would implant them into a woman's body. So he was not somebody who was from outside the community of scientists working in this area, which that for me was a big distinction, right? He was one of our own who kind of went off the rails. He went ahead at a time when the community of scientists and policymakers and people who do bioethics like me all thought a bunch of steps would need to happen before we could ever begin going forward with the clinical trial of modifying human embryos. Many steps, and therefore many years. He jumped ahead or discounted or didn't care about all of those steps and went ahead on his own. That's what, for me, made him and makes him a rogue. I will say one more thing before we leave this, if it's okay, Carrie, which is Walter Isaacson just published a new book called Codebreaker.
It's wonderful.
Which is about, it's a great book. And there's an entire section about exactly the case that we're talking about, which includes a pretty good retelling of the 2018 Hong Kong summit. I was actually there, spoke on the program at that meeting and was in the audience when that happened, and we all sort of felt like we were witnessing a kind of moment, a historical moment in science, and the way the story is told by Walter Isaacson, I think, kind of confirms that. So if people are interested, there's a really great way to access the backstory.
Just a note there, Jeff, I think Isaacson describes, and I think you concur with this, that, you know, this is announced, you're in the hall, you feel like you're witnessing a version of history, everybody breaks, the media converges on you and many of the other scientists who are emerging from that. What did you understand at the moment about what this would mean? Did you have a clear understanding of what would happen in the days and months after?
A little bit. Well, so there was a fair amount of media frenzy even before the presentation in Hong Kong, because little bits of information were being trickled out in a very odd way through a YouTube series of YouTube videos, and then a story that ran in the AP, and then another one in the MIT Tech Review. And so we were getting calls from media asking for comments to reports that we hadn't actually read or seen. So that made it a little bit challenging, but there was a lot of expectation that this was going to be an issue that wasn't going to go away anytime soon. And then a lot of scrambling about what to do to try to get the science back onto a responsible track, or a perception that it was, you know, this was a one-off situation that wouldn't happen again. And what might the scientific and policy community do to assure that? And so it frankly made for a lot of very interesting work for people like me. We've been working on the issues around governance and ethics and policy of this new technology now for a number of years, and continue to do so.
And Professor Comer, a note here from Nick on Twitter. He says, this feels like more than an incremental advance. The ethics conversations haven't caught up to the new reality, are kind of fun to brainstorm. I worry about charlatans jumping on this, making extraordinary claims beyond what we can do yet. Is that something that concerns you?
There are a lot of things that concern me. Yeah. obviously, I'm in this field, and I think that I'm very responsible, but I know that there are a lot of people who aren't, and I know that, you know, the main reason why, you know, CRISPR and Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna got the Nobel Prize for CRISPR when genome editing tools had existed before that. The reason why, you know, CRISPR was sort of the thing that burst the field open is that it is so easy to use. Mm-hmm. And so you don't need a ton of expertise to use it. And so that kind of, you know, opens the floodgates of, well, you know, there's like a much larger pool of scientists who could be using the technology now. And so we need to be very careful.
Conversation this morning about understanding gene editing, and some of which is referred to. There's a lot of discussion about CRISPR. It's this chemical tool that acts like scissors in cutting genetic material. And as you've just heard Alexis Comer say, it is easier to use and more widely available to other scientists, which again enhances its promise and the interest in it, but also some of the ethical considerations, which is what we're talking about this morning. What's the future of this in curing and treating disease? What's the promise of the research? What are the ethical challenges of gene editing? Alexis Comer, one of our guests. She runs a lead researcher at the Comer Lab, and she's a professor of chemistry at the University of California, San Diego. And Jeff Kahn, a familiar voice here, now the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. You hear us developing our conversation this morning on what this is and where some of the ethical considerations are. If you might have questions, observations as you hear our conversation develop, what kinds of ethical concerns come up for you? What kind of promise? I mean, let your imagination roam a bit here. How could gene editing be used to treat perhaps a disease that's in your family or affects a loved one of yours? What might the promise of that be? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Professor Comer, I wanted to ask you about, I mentioned in the introduction, researchers able to safely remove a gene from the liver cells of patients with a serious disease. This is Dr. Doudna's company, isn't it, that did this CRISPR research on the liver genes? How did it work?
Yeah, so this really, really awesome clinical data came from Intellia. It's, you know, one, she's been involved in a lot of companies, so that's just one of them. But so this was, I'm super excited about this because this is one of these huge kind of unknowns in the field. So now we know that it works and it works well. We work with these tools in vitro, so with cells in a petri dish, so to speak. And you had mentioned earlier, actually, that you know, people have taken blood cells, or scientists have taken blood cells out of patients,
yeah,
and then used CRISPR in the laboratory on those cells. And then, you know, we put the cells back in the person sometimes. Other times, you know, there's lots of different therapies here. But nobody had ever really used CRISPR in the body of a person. So in vivo, like take the Cas9 or the CRISPR, or the tool, and put it, you know, systemically into that person and confirm that, first of all, it can find the cells where it needs to go, and then it can edit them with, you know, high enough efficiency so that we can actually see a phenotypic response. We can start to see the disease phenotypes go away. Mm-hmm. And the big question was, is it safe? Mm-hmm. There was a lot of speculation about if there would be severe adverse effects, if the patient would get a really bad immune response to this, you know, foreign thing, this tool being put into them. And the data were amazing. I mean, there was really great efficiency. Yeah, it went you know, to the liver. We got there. It was very efficient. They could start to see the phenotype. And so the phenotype for this disease was there's this protein that kind of folds out of control and generates these amyloid plaques, kind of like what you've heard with Alzheimer's. And so they saw levels of that protein go way down.
Wow.
And there were no serious adverse effects. So no crazy immune response or anything. And so that was a big question, was how safe is this? You know, we know that it works really well, again, in a petri dish, but that's a far cry from using it inside a person.
I'm coming back to the immune response here in just a minute. But, Jeff, I read what Dr. Doudness said about this stunning research that Professor Comer is talking about. And it sounded like, I mean, she is suggesting in what Alexis just described that we're entering an age when genes can be edited inside the body, which is incredible. Okay, here's what she said. It's a critical first step in being able to inactivate, repair, or replace any gene that causes disease anywhere in the body. This opens up the possibility to treat a wide range of diseases that we haven't been able to address so far. Will you just interpret that from, you know, from, again, a promise perspective, but also, boy, I mean, again, are the ethics of this, are we understanding the potential of the ethics here?
It's a good question. And I want to maybe provide a little more context, which is, in some sense, this is a really important milestone in a really long story, where people have been trying to do what you've just described, modify individuals at the level of their genes for over 30 years. We called it gene therapy and still do. Mm-hmm. But the tools were just not very good until now. So CRISPR and other genome editing tools provide the precision and reliability and safety in the way that Alexis described that just didn't exist until now. And so gene therapy up to this point has been reserved for really serious diseases in people for whom there are just no other therapies available. It just was too risky, cost too much. It didn't work very well. And so these tools, CRISPR and tools like them, provide like just a giant toolbox that didn't exist before. And so it's a really important moment that's been made possible by this technology and opens up the promise of what people have been trying to do for a really long time. So in addition to the excitement of really good data coming out, as Alexis described and as Jennifer Doudna, you know, was quoted as saying, it also is a kind of exciting moment for people who've been slaving away mm-hmm. in the laboratory trying to make this work, not so successfully up until now. So it's a really, really important moment for therapy. It raises different issues than like the example of the Hong Kong story that we talked about before, because we're talking about modifying individuals and nothing will happen to their offspring, right? They won't pass on the genetic change that is made to them to treat the disease or disability that they might have. And that's a very different matter than modifying embryos or modifying the gametes in people that will turn into embryos. So that's where the action actually is from an ethics and some of the technology standpoint, modifying sperm and eggs. Actually sperm much easier than eggs. And then those modified sperm could produce offspring. And whatever change was introduced to the sperm would then be introduced to the person made from that sperm, and they would then pass it on to future generations. And so those are very different kinds of ethical issues than the ones that will effectively modifications that will die with the individual who's been modified.
Got it. Let me take some calls here to Robert, listening in the Twin Cities. Hi, Robert. Good to have you on the phone.
Thank you. Yes, I have a daughter who is a genetic counselor in Rochester, Minnesota, in the Mayo Clinic. And she diagnosed a genetic disorder with my wife, which is called Fabry disease. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty rare, mostly in males, but the community is kind of changing its mind about that. Anyway, the disorder is not only in her genes, it is carried through the X chromosome. So therefore, of my three children, I have one daughter, not the one in Rochester, but one in the Twin Cities, who also has this disease. And we believe her brother died of early death because of an enlarged heart and so forth. Will this CRISPR be something that might help in that area? The cost is a major thing. We are in our 60s, and the cost to do this is over $30,000 for each injection that, or infusion that she has to go through every 2 weeks. So it's really expensive, and it's an insurance issue, obviously, too.
So could CRISPR, is this a disease that would be a candidate for CRISPR kind of intervention? Professor Comer, I wonder if you know that.
I am not super familiar with this particular disease, but, you know, there are a lot of things to think about. And so, first of all, I mean, it sounds like, you know, at the basis of this, it's caused by some sequence in the DNA that's different than, you know, most people. And so that in itself, yeah, we can, that's exactly what CRISPR does. It goes in and it changes the sequence. When we talk about, you know, using CRISPR as a therapeutic, there are, it's not that simple, though. There's all these other things that, these other barriers sort of in the way. And so the things that you need to think about are, in terms of the pathology of the disease, you know, like what organ would we need to send the tool to do the editing? And so in the case of this, you know, the Intellia example, that disease was caused by the liver cells producing this protein that would then, you know, fold to create these amyloid plaques, which is why the CRISPR was sent to the liver cells. So in the case of this particular disease that your daughter has, you know, what is the pathology? What is the organ that would need to be targeted? And then do we have a technology to allow us to deliver the CRISPR tool to that organ in order to do the editing? But one thing I want to point out really quickly, but before I stop talking, is you mentioned, you know, it's this currently your daughter has to go through this treatment every 2 weeks. It's expensive. It's probably not pleasant as well. Whereas with CRISPR, the you know, in theory, it's you're one and done. You deliver it, it goes in and it corrects it at the root source. And then it's, you know, this is, you know, if we can get it efficient enough, you're done. That's it. You don't have to, it's not like a treatment. It's a cure.
It's incredible. Yeah. Wow. Alexis Comer with us this morning from the University of California, San Diego. Jeff Kahn with us from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And your calls and questions as we consider the promise and the future and the ethical challenges of gene editing. We're going to get a look at the latest news. When we come back, I want to ask our guests about, I was reading a New York Times article about some of the other technology that's being developed, including techniques that allow researchers to make less drastic cuts to the genome and only go in and tinker with one genetic letter at a time. How different is that? Is it different from what CRISPR uses? So we'll talk about that and more of your calls about how this might apply to therapies and cures for diseases that we're all thinking about that may appear in our families, and then some of the ethical considerations that come to mind. I see a question here about whether this could be used to enhance humans. I think that's a good question for Jeff. Back to our conversation now, Jeff Kahn with us and Alexis Comer, and to the phones to Ashley in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Ashley, thanks for waiting so much. I'm glad we could get to your question. Tell me what you're thinking about. Ashley will have to call back to Jean in Minneapolis. Hi, Jean. Thank you for waiting. What do you
want
to know?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, from what I've learned actually on NPR, is the unpredictability of gene editing. And my sister had a cat who Japanese scientists wanted to eliminate tails, and she had incredible problems with her intestines and constipation and so on.
Okay, so
that was unintended, but that relates to a COVID-19 vaccination conversation I had, because it doesn't, there's no predictability of what else can be edited beside your target. And so that's a big
Gene, I'm puzzled over what this question actually is.
Well, with R or mRNA for vaccinations, does it edit other genes? Or, you know, is this because it seems to me that the science doesn't really know how it works.
Okay. So, Alexis, I'm going to say, as we have said many, many times, work on the mRNA technology has been going on for 20 years at the minimum. It has just now been used for vaccines. I guess Gene is asking about whether there is any connection between how gene editing works and this mRNA technology. Is there?
Not too. I mean, it's they both use or involve nucleic acids. I am not a virologist or an immunologist, but with the mRNA vaccines, you're right that technology has been being developed for a really long time. And the reason why, you know, it just kind of exploded recently is because previously there wasn't really a good opportunity to do a large clinical trial and see if it would be efficacious and be, you know, a really good vaccine and prevent you know, catching a virus. And so the pandemic sort of allowed those large clinical trials to happen. But I want to mention one thing about the mechanism by which these mRNA vaccines work. So they deliver mRNA into your body. And even though you think, you know, oh, RNA, DNA, they're the same thing, right? They're totally different. mRNA has a very, very short half-life, so it's not nearly as stable as DNA, and it does not get integrated into your genome at all. It's basically just sort of like the blueprint for your cells to make a bunch of this spike protein, and it gets degraded very quickly, and then it's gone super fast. And in no way, shape, or form does it do anything to your genomic DNA at all.
Okay, maybe maybe that's where the confusion was, Alexis. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I hear this a lot, you know, my research has been in nucleic acid chemistry for many years, so I know these little intricacies. But mRNA vaccine, no genome editing is involved there. It just gives your cell the blueprint to make the spike protein, so that your body can, you know what it's looking for, and it can start generating antibodies against that spike protein in advance.
Okay.
I do want to mention, though, about these adverse effects, and Gene is totally right. I actually mentioned this earlier, but I used kind of different words when I said, back to my example at the very beginning, you have a C in this location and I have a T, and we, you know, use genome editing to convert my T back to a C. But again, we already have you as an example of a person where that sequence already exists and that person is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the Chinese twins, that was not the case. So it was this brand new sequence, and we don't know what the consequences of that is. And so there absolutely, you know, needs to be a lot of back research to figure out what are the ways that we are changing the DNA sequence with these therapeutics, and do we already know that that is going to be safe? That is absolutely something that is very important, and that everybody is you know, working very hard on. And, you know, to get FDA approval, this is something that's taken very, very seriously. And you absolutely have to have clear evidence supporting the fact that the way that you are going to be modifying the genome is going to produce a sequence that we know is safe.
Call from Peter in Prescott Valley, Arizona. Hi, Peter. Thanks to you for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Thanks for taking my call, Terry. As with all positive things, which all we've been talking about so far, is the great ways you could, you know, correct diseases and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We also have, unfortunately, the negative in our world. So I was wondering, could this technology be used to enhance human beings, which will make you better, stronger, faster in general? And if so, well, then my mind kind of goes to, unfortunately, could this be weaponized?
All right.
Could, it's the whole ethical question you talk about, but kind of on a country scale, could a country take their scientists and start using this in bad ways? And I'll use a kind of a funny example, not funny, but facetious, maybe. Let's say China weaponizes it and makes super soldiers, for example. It just made me think of it when you said that the Hong Kong doctor is no longer in the picture. I think one of your
guests said,
and it made me wonder, where did he go?
Okay.
Did he go to China? And is he now doing his work there under the covers,
Is that, I mean, are the geopolitics of this something that ethicists like yourself also have to consider?
We're in the midst of an international discussion, which tries to take account of, you know, the sort of more likely and maybe less likely scenarios. But Peter is raising, you know, sort of the range and scope of things that you have to think through. It turns out to be very, very difficult to figure out how to govern an emerging technology globally. We don't have good models for that. Like there are treaties for things that have to do with atomic weapons, right? The handling of bioweapons and things, but not for an emerging technology that can be used in all sorts of really positive ways. And so it's a big challenge to try to figure out how to keep the technology on a path that will yield the kinds of, you know, really positive therapeutic outcomes that we've been talking about without allowing for, I guess, or incentivizing maybe even the kinds of concerns that Peter is articulating. Dr. He, we actually know, is still in China, and he is so this is part of the geopolitics, actually. Mm-hmm. After the Hong Kong symposium that we've been talking about, there was obviously a lot of attention. Dr. He didn't actually seem to understand that it would cause a lot of negative blowback. The announcement
really?
Would cause a lot of negative reaction, huh. And thought instead he would be lauded as a pioneer and have a hero in his own country. And it wasn't clear that the Chinese government didn't agree with that. Sorry for the double negative there. But in the aftermath of the scientific community and the world community and effectively a total consensus against the going forward in the way that he did, he has been arrested. He is in prison for some undisclosed amount of time. And so he's really out of the picture. But as far as we all know, he's still in China, but not doing science any longer. I think Peter's comments raise a really important, more general question, which is what about potential enhancement uses of this technology, which we can certainly talk about, which don't go straight to weaponization and creating super soldiers, but rather how do we think about using a technology that is really created to help cure or prevent disease, but could easily be used in ways that could also lead to what we would call enhancement. And is that acceptable? And if so, for what purposes?
And I guess, Jeff, is the question that comes to my mind is, even if it is not acceptable to ethicists, the people that do what you do, is that where, I mean, is it almost inevitable that that's where this technology is going in some places?
I'm nodding. You can't see me, of course, but yes, that's exactly the concern. And if you think about how therapies make their way through what's been termed a translational pipeline in our system, and it's sort of across the globe in liberal democracies, they go from bench work like Professor Comer conducts. And if they're lucky enough to have good outcomes, then they get maybe picked up by a company, or a company gets created, and eventually they get information gets presented to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, for approval, so that that thing can be sold as a medicine. Mm-hmm. And so once that approval has happened, it becomes very, very difficult in our system to control it. So if a new genome editing therapy was created to treat children with muscular dystrophy, for example, which is a muscle wasting disease, which is inherited genetically caused. That same technique could easily be used in people who didn't have muscular dystrophy to help them get more muscles. Huh. That's got a lot of obvious applications as a kind of enhancement. Yeah. And how can, in our system, we prevent that from happening, or do we need to? Right. And so that's the question. And so one of the ways to think about that dividing line is there's still some risk, even though these tools seem to be really precise and reliable and hopefully safe and effective, but there's still some risk. And so the benefit has to be sufficient to outweigh that risk of harm. And if it's treating a disease or preventing the symptoms of a disease, that seems worth it in a way that getting more muscular mm-hmm. when you're healthy and normal doesn't necessarily seem so. So we need to pay attention to the risk and benefit and the way, you know, is it safe enough for the proposed use? And maybe there'll be a time when it is.
Yeah.
And then we can say, well, if people are willing to go that route and pay for the cost and understand the risks and benefits, then let them do so. But I don't think we're there yet.
Ashley from Sioux Falls is back. And Ashley, I'm really glad you called back because I think you wanted to speak to something that Jeff was just saying about this.
Yeah, that conversation is perfect. I actually have cystic fibrosis. Uh-huh. And so much of my life has been based upon that risk versus benefit. I can tell you, you know, when I was born, the life expectancy of someone with CF was 18 years old, and I'm 34 currently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the very reason that I'm still alive is because of pushing the ethical envelope. And, you know, we're going to continue to do that. Something, you know, you're speaking about today, the CRISPR and the gene editing, that is the greatest hope for cystic fibrosis, and especially people who aren't affected by current technologies, and ultimately finding that cure. You know, I think what's so difficult about conversations like this is that it's very polarizing, that we look at science and we want to believe that there's a black and white. And having survived and, you know, continuing to do my best to survive through the healthcare system and with a chronic illness, the healthcare world and science itself is very gray. And it's very, you know, situational. We don't think about a disease in and of itself, or even this technology, not just benefiting a person with that underlying disease, but the greater community. You know, my cystic fibrosis just doesn't affect me. Mm-hmm. It affects my family and every relationship. It affects my burden on the healthcare system and mm-hmm. how costly it is to keep me alive. You know, so looking at this technology just not as a benefit for the human condition of myself, but the greater human condition and the symptom of everybody deserves to be healthy and deserves the right to live their greatest existence.
Yeah, Ashley, I'm really glad you called back because you continue to remind us this is not just an academic conversation, and we want to make sure that we put the benefits front and center in this discussion. Professor Comer, if you would just reflect on that for a moment, on what Ashley has said.
So, I mean, that was amazing. I can't believe that, you know, your life expectancy was 18 and you're 34. That's awesome. That's, you know, a huge, you know, that just speaks to the testament of, you know, science and the things that we're doing to push the envelope. And that makes, you know, me so much more, you know, even more, if it's possible, excited to go into work and to continue to push the frontiers of science. One thing that I want to mention is that, you're thinking about, you know, my genetics training, which I will admit is limited, but I've gotten into that field lately. So it's very easy to break a gene. Okay. To screw it up. It takes, you know, one base that's wrong can cause sickle cell. But, you know, these traits that you're talking about, enhanced muscle mass or, you know, maybe enhanced intelligence, those are what we call polygenic. And we don't understand them very well. So, and there are lots of mutations throughout multiple genes that need to all occur simultaneously to create these enhancements. And so we're definitely not there to the point where we could say, oh, if you just, you know, edit this one spot in your genome, that'll make you super smart. We're definitely not there. I don't know how long it will take to get there, but the the algorithms behind understanding this are just so complicated, and we need so much more sequencing data. So for now, don't worry about generating super soldiers. It's like, you know, from a standpoint of what mutations to introduce, we have no idea. This is what makes me excited to go into work every day is people like Ashley. And, you know, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. And we will, you know, continue to push the envelope for you.
Alexis, I have one more question here about something that I saw some researchers say, that CRISPR could be the next antibiotic. And I was reading this article about why, and it said, in their recent study, Dr. Edgel and his colleagues successfully used a CRISPR-associated enzyme called Cas9 to eliminate a species of Salmonella. By programming the Cas9 enzyme to view the bacterium itself as the enemy, Dr. Edgel and his colleagues were able to force Salmonella to make lethal cuts to its own genome. That really blew my mind. I've got just about 2 minutes left here. But what do you think about the potential for that?
Yeah, that's something that we had, you know, people in the field have been talking about for a while. And, you know, that's sort of like the original kind of reason for CRISPR's existence is this, it's an immune system for bacteria. And the way, you know, it's programmed to find a particular sequence of DNA and then cut it. And in, you know, certain single-celled organisms like bacteria and phage are like the viruses of bacteria.
Right.
Cutting the DNA degrades it and makes those cells die, basically. But our cells have, you know, this really extensive, amazing DNA repair pathways. And DNA repair mechanisms. And so we're able, you know, scientists are able to kind of leverage that in order to change the sequence of the DNA into something new when we use these tools in human cells. Whereas, you know, in bacteria, it cuts it up, it can't repair it, and then that cell dies.
You know, I have to say, when we started with an hour on CRISPR, I thought, well, that should be enough time. My gosh, we've barely scratched the surface here. Alexis Comer, thank you so much. Really a pleasure to have you here. Jeff, always a pleasure to talk to you again. Thanks so much for being on the show. Alexis Comer with us, professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego, lead researcher at the Comer Lab. And Jeff Kahn, you know, formerly at the University of Minnesota, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and also teaches bioethics at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. Today's technical director was Veronica Rodriguez. Miss a show? Search for NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.